Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All this week, we're visiting some of our favorite arts and entertainment conversations we've had on the program. Later this hour, you are going to hear from the University of Illinois Black Chorus, not just a conversation, a performance. But first, an Illinois documentary called Minding the Gap got lots of notice at film festivals around the world, including at Sundance, where it won a special jury award. The film was also nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary Feature. It follows the lives of three young skateboarders in Rockford and the family they form skating, which helped them cope with abuse, death, and domestic violence.
Take one.
I'm making this film because I saw myself in your story.
I always felt like I didn't fit in with my family.
My parents ran this very controlling house. I ran away a lot.
Skateboarding is more of a family than my family.
We sat down with filmmaker Bing Liu. He's the producer and director of Minding the Gap, and he joined us from our studios at Northwestern University in Evanston. Hi, Bing. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, Bing, I know you're behind the camera, but this is very much your story, too. I wanted to just to start by asking, where did you first meet the other two guys in the film?
When I was a sophomore or junior in high school, that was when the first public skate park opened up in Rockford, Illinois. So I went there, and one of the guys who's one of the main characters is Zach. He's a couple years younger than me, and he went to a different high school, but that's where I met him, and he was a really good skateboarder, so I filmed him as part of the, you know, part of the wider community of skateboarders that I was filming. We didn't hang out that much outside of the skate park, and after a few years, I left town, but when I came back to Rockford to make the film, you know, I reconnected with him because he was about to become a father himself. And then with Kier, he's much younger. He's 7 or 8 years younger than me. And so I caught him, you know, as a little kid at the skate park on video a couple times. But I didn't really get to know him that well until I came back to make the film.
And when did you start skateboarding? When you were in middle school?
Yeah, I think I was like 12 or 13.
And I've never skateboarded, but there are these beautiful scenes of the guys skateboarding together down the street and around the skate park. It looks like a flock of birds flying. Is that how it feels to skateboard, like flying?
Yeah, it feels, you know, I was just talking about this with someone today. You know, it's actually much more like ballet or dancing than it is like something, you know, aggressive, which is the way that I think sometimes it gets portrayed.
And how did you shoot those scenes? Because there's a lot of scenes of you following the guys. Are you on a skateboard as well?
Most of the time I'm running on foot. I'd been working, as you know, in the camera department on movies and TV shows for a long time. And I worked with a lot of Steadicam operators, and I saw that as, you know, a great way to capture skateboarding. So I just used a sort of a poor man's Steadicam called the Glide Cam. I was able to run behind them. So yeah, I really wanted to capture a fresh way of, I really wanted to shoot skateboarding in a way that translated, you know, the sort of emotional, like human side of it, rather than this focus on the tricks. And so I trained for a year or two to really get to the point where I was intuitive using the glide cam, running on foot to follow skateboarding.
You trained for a year before you started shooting?
Yeah, I mean, when I say train, I mean, you know, I was just experimenting with shooting skateboarding, like outside of doing Mind in the Gap with this glide cam. So, you know, the first few months it was pretty rocky, but I eventually got better and better at it. And so by the time I shot Mind in the Gap, you know, I felt really comfortable with that tool.
So there is, to the point that you made about emotion, there's this really delicate, I think very respectful balance that you achieve in a way I haven't often seen between these subjects who are your friends, but also maintaining both their story and your story. Was that something you thought a lot about?
I think it started when I was growing up. You know, I felt like I was a pseudo-therapist for a lot of my friends. It's just sort of what helped me get through my childhood. And so by the time I dug into Zach and Kiera's lives, you know, it felt pretty natural.
And so I think when we're thinking about this, there's a lot of this story where there's a lot of different things, both when you're talking about you, but also with Zach, and you mentioned before fatherhood. I think fatherhood's a really important part of this story. And there are scenes of the guys at the skate park holding Zach's baby and taking care of him. And I feel like we don't often get to see the perspective of really young fathers like we do with teenage moms. Is that part of why you wanted to include that?
I mean, when I first started the project, I really wanted to look at intergenerational growth. And, you know, I felt like there was a lot happening with, you know, young men either modeling their fathers or, you know, going against what their fathers represented if the relationship wasn't healthy. So that was something I really wanted to dig into. And that's partly why, you know, in documentary, it's all about access and casting. That's often what makes for a great film. And so, you know, Zach and Keir were people that I found after a year of traveling around the country, looking for people to follow. And Zach just really, you know, his charisma just really screams off the screen. You really want to watch him. But also, he was about to become a father, and that was not something I'd found with other skateboarders I was looking at.
Some of the really wrenching scenes revolve around Keir and the death of his father and how hard it was for him to handle. Keir says at one point that taking part in this documentary with you was like free therapy. Was that true for you as well?
Not in making the film. I mean, for me, you know, I was a one-man band for most of the production besides this one scene where I hired a sound person and a camera person to film me filming. So for me, it was like, you know, I was just caught up in the nitty-gritty of making the film. You know, what do I need to film next? You know, when, you know, I have to have this rough cut ready for this feedback screening, you know, in a few months, let me focus on that. You know, where's Keir going to be at on this day when I have time to go out to Rockford? So I was very much caught up in the making of the film, and there wasn't anybody pressing back on me in the way that I was pressing on Zach and Keir to really try to dig into the past and what it meant.
There is this threat of abuse, and as you're talking about sort of the difficult stories, there's abuse by fathers and stepfathers, and it also, I think it's very interesting how this cuts across all the racial lines of the film, whether it's African-American or Asian or white. When we're thinking about that part of the story, how hard, was that something you were looking for in particular, or is that something that came out as you were filming?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was really the point of making the film. I mean, the skateboarding, I mean, if you add up the numbers, it's probably only like 10 or 15 minutes of actual skateboarding in the film. It's really a coming of age film that really looks at violence in the home and where it comes from and, you know, how it affects boys who grow up. So skateboarding always felt like the sugar that was, you know, added to the spoonful of medicine. So that's, it was pretty, you know, it was just sort of finding a way to get at it in a way that I hadn't seen before.
And there's a connection that you, a point that you make. You talk about statistics, and you talk about statistics in Rockford, and you mentioned the role that domestic violence plays in violent crime statistics. Was that also another way for you to be, for us to be thinking about domestic violence?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I feel like domestic violence as a subject, even hearing the word, can really conjure up sort of, you know, media or studies or, you know, discussions in the classroom maybe that are really on the nose. And I feel like, you know, having experienced it and witnessed it myself personally, it's not really, it doesn't really quite get at the experience of living through it. You know, I think the experience of living through it is that it's just an aspect of your life as you grow up, and it's there, it's ever present, but it's not this dreary, dark thing all the time. I mean, you still have these moments of elation and joy. You still have, you know, these feelings of love and hope. And so, you know, I was trying to find a way to tackle the experience of domestic violence in a way that wasn't too on the nose, that just felt like this, you know, something in the ether of their lives. And so things like filming the billboards that are in the film, or things like including, you know, the couple snippets of statistics were ways that I felt comfortable doing that.
I also think that there is this really, you said, you mentioned it before, this scene where you confront your mom, and this is where you were saying you had hired someone, about the abuse that you suffered at the hands of her husband, your stepfather. And she says she wishes that she was stronger and she doesn't know what to say to you. And I wonder if you think part of what keeps the cycle of abuse going is when people don't talk about things.
Yeah, that's certainly the start of it. I mean, it's just brushed behind closed doors. That's a big factor. I think there's a lot of factors that figure into why the cycle keeps spinning. There's not a lot of, you know, common language that we have to be able to talk about it without, like, this, you know, shameful look down at the floor sort of feeling that glosses over those conversations. So,
well, and it's nuanced, as you said, right? Because it's really complicated, because these aren't relationships where it is all about the violence or the anger. And you see that through the relationships that are in the dock, the way that people relate to each other.
Yeah, I mean, I want to complicate the narrative. I mean, it's not just like good person, good behavior, bad behavior. It's so tied into just the whole melange of feelings, the complicated situations that life brings up, you know, the way that we make mistakes and grow. I mean, it's all part of it.
Bing, so you're from Beijing and you grew up in Rockford. How did you end up wanting to become a filmmaker?
I think it was just, you know, I get obsessed with stuff. My folks are from the southwest of China in Sichuan, and I was sort of shipped around a lot to different folks because my parents were going to school in different cities at the time. And then when we moved to the States, we actually moved to Alabama, and my mom and dad divorced, and I was just left home alone a lot. And I was 5, and then we moved to LA, and it was like more time sort of being a latchkey kid. So I escaped to my imagination a lot. I watched a lot of movies and played with a bunch of toys, and you know, got obsessed with certain things. I think skateboarding became an obsession when I first started doing it. And then when I first picked up a camera, I was 14, I became obsessed with that too. It became this way to create new realities. And then I went to school to become an English teacher, actually, majored in literature. And then while I was in school, I just got a production assistant job. And little did I know, for the next 10 years, I would just be working as a freelance filmmaker.
This was produced with Cartemquin Films here. What was it like to also shoot this in Illinois and produce it here as well?
Felt really nice. I mean, I'd worked as a crew member on productions in New York and LA, and it's just, you know, such a different vibe on the coast. I think there's something very special about working in the Midwest. There's so much like cultural richness, and there's so much, I don't know. I mean, I feel like people are, there's something that just I really like about the Midwest. And it was really awesome working with Cartemquin because, you know, they're this award-winning production company that really feels more like a community than a company. I mean, they're housed in this old apartment that the founder bought in the 70s, you know, and if you end up editing in one of their edit suites, it's like, you know, you're sitting on a roller chair, and if you let go, your roller chair slowly starts just rolling towards a wall. I mean, it's just got that sort of character to it. And everybody that works there, you know, works there for the love. There's something really wholesome and nice about being a Midwest filmmaker.
And I wonder what it's like also now to be a Midwest filmmaker and have venues like Amazon or Netflix, or in your case, Hulu, to help produce these docs or films. Does that make it easier?
Well, Hulu didn't acquire it until after Sundance. But it definitely feels nice to have the audience reach that these platforms provide. I think it's, you know, I think in the 2000s, the film industry became a little bit more democratic with cheaper equipment. But now with streaming platforms, you know, there's a more democratic sort of audience reach as well. I'm really happy that Hulu, you know, liked the film enough to pick it up. And I'm really excited because they have a really young audience, and I'm already seeing like the comments flow in from the trailer.
So Hulu picked it up afterwards. Were you surprised by that?
You know, everything's been a surprise. Getting into Sundance has been a surprise. I mean, this has been a crazy, crazy ride.
That's producer and director Bing Liu. We spoke with him last year. His film, Minding the Gap, was also nominated for an Oscar in the Best Documentary Feature category. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For many Illinois towns, murals are a way to showcase local history while also making the town beautiful. But what do you do once those murals start to age? And what do towns do when they might not have the knowledge or funds to properly take care of them? Jana Groharing is the executive director of Sterling Main Street, an organization working to preserve historic murals in Sterling, Illinois. Sterling's on the Rock River, just about an hour southwest of Rockford. And Tara Bedi is the city councilwoman in Streeter, Illinois, about an hour north of Bloomington. She also helped organize Streeter's 5-day mural painting festival called the Wall Dogs Festival. That brought 16 new murals to Streeter. I spoke with both of them last summer, but we actually started with a caller. Here's Danielle from Freeport telling us about her favorite mural in her town.
Hi, yes. We have a mural in our downtown on the side of a historic building. And in the spirit of becoming a more cyclist-friendly community, it's a cyclist on a bike, and it's bright and beautiful, and yeah, it's definitely my favorite.
Oh, thanks for sharing that. Councilwoman Bidai, I wonder how much of what you wanted to do for Streeter was what Danielle was just talking about with this five-day mural festival. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. We booked the Wall Dogs, which is an international organization, 4 years ago, and it lined up perfectly with our sesquicentennial. So when I contacted them and they said our first date was 2018, and knowing that our sesquicentennial was that year, and turned out Illinois' bicentennial was also this year, we thought it was just a great fit for our community. So we worked with the Wall Dogs, planned, fundraised for the last 4 years, and ended up doing 17 murals over a five-day period.
Wow. And I love how some of the art highlights Streeter's history. How did you decide what the topics of the murals would be?
We had we started with over 50 topics where we tried to find whether it was a famous person, place, or just something nostalgic with our community, just because we wanted to celebrate our history with this event. From there, we had kind of our committee voted, as well as we had some social media where we asked people for ideas. We had our first fundraising event where we allowed people to vote on what they wanted to see for topics, and just kind of decided from there.
Mm-hmm. And I know there's murals, for example, that show Clyde Isitomba, the Streeter native who discovered Pluto.
Clyde Tomba, yes.
Yeah, which yes. is great. So we've been talking about new murals. Jana, I wanted to ask you about old murals. What are some of the historic pieces someone can find in Sterling?
We started our first mural in 1995. It went up. It was just a local group of individuals who got together who wanted to see the public art project done. And so they started fundraising and putting up murals. But most of ours are, well, I shouldn't say most of them, all of ours are historic in nature, kind of telling the story of Sterling. The first one that went up was a street scene of our downtown as it looked in the early 1900s. We've got one of an electric railway car that used to run between Sterling and Dixon, Illinois in the early 1900s. It only ran for about 20 years. Just a lot of old industrial photos, the original bridge that connected Sterling and Rock Falls that was wiped out by an ice jam decades ago, our community's founders, lots of I mean, they're all very historical related and based on actual photographs that we've found through our historical society and whatnot.
And is it hard to keep these murals preserved? I imagine because of the nature of it being public art, is that mm-hmm. a tough thing to have them maintained?
The maintenance piece, I think, you know, our mural society was founded in 1995. And though they were on a good steady stretch of installing one to three murals a year from 1995 through 2007. And after 2007, the group kind of fizzled out as people aged, things like that. They lost sight of each other, and nothing was really being done actively to continue to fundraise for the group or pursue new murals. In 2013, the Lincoln Highway Coalition came to us and wanted to put a mural up in our town, and at that point, they didn't know where to go with it, so they reached out to the Main Street organization, which didn't exist back when the murals were being installed. We've been around since 2009, so they reached out to the Main Street organization at that point to help coordinate where the new mural would go, and then said, hey, you know what, we really need somebody to take a look at keeping these, you know, in good shape. At that point, a lot of them were starting to show wear, just, you know, fade from sun. You know, we've got a couple of them, you know, with city streetscapes now. You've got trees brushing against buildings, kind of damaging the faces of some of the murals. We've got some peeling paint, and said, would, you know, Main Street be interested in taking this on and kind of becoming the future caretaker of these murals? And we said, sure, and haven't really gotten our footing yet on how to tackle this massive project.
Yeah, that sounds like a big project. Councilwoman mm-hmm. Bidai, I wonder with Streeter and the Wall Dogs, if they, I don't know how much guidance they gave you all on this, mm-hmm. on this, on the preserving or maintaining side. But I just wonder if I could just end by asking actually about the goal of this. We're thinking about how close you guys are to Starved Rock State Park, how many visitors Starved Rock gets over the years. I wonder, is that part of the murals as well? Are you hoping to tap into tourism and have folks come by?
Absolutely. I think we'd be, with us being in such close proximity, it'd be silly to not try to get into Starved Rock. There's actually a group that's trying to do like a regional Starved Rock country, kind of a big, there's a tourism magazine and everything based on that. So we did, you know, we advertised in that guide, Heritage Corridor, all the local tourism guides, but absolutely, we'd love to get people visiting Streeter just to come see the murals, spend the day there, visit our local shops.
Well, our friends at our partner station, WNIJ, have been reporting on this. They inspired this segment. We're going to tweet out links to their story so you can read more about this and see the great photos of these murals. But I want to thank Jana Groh-Herring and Councilwoman Tara Bidai for being with me. Ladies, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This past March, the U of I Black Chorus hosted a symposium on Black sacred music on the Urbana campus, and it all culminated in a concert at the Kraner Center for the Performing Arts. We got a little preview of their concert this spring when they stopped by our studio. Brianna Tyler is the TA and a master's student getting her degree in music education. Michaela Odom and Jerry Boffor were both seniors at the university. I started by asking Michaela how long she'd been a member of Black Chorus.
I have been a day one Black Chorus member as soon as I stepped foot on campus back in 2015.
So home for you, Michaela, is Naperville. Jerry, for you, home is in Chicago in Rogers Park. Was this joining Black Chorus something you intended to do before you got to campus?
I kind of joined Black Chorus by accident. The way that happened was sitting down for registration. One of my friends was next to me and she was already involved with the choir. And she was telling me, oh, maybe you should join Black Chorus. I was like, okay, I'll just give it a try. And then I just signed up for the class. First day, I just came in. And then the rest is history.
Brianna, so this is a chorus, and this weekend you're all participating in a symposium on Black sacred music, but you sing music from all different genres, right?
So Black Chorus focuses on the African-American music tradition, so it's not just gospel. It's spiritual songs. It is gospels included, but there's also soul, funk, R&B, blues. We've even done some hip-hop. We've had some rap. We always do a tribute section. So in that tribute section, we dedicate a portion of our performances to pop stars and popular music that's outside of the sacred music tradition. But we predominantly do, in our first half of our concert, usually focus on that sacred music, Black sacred music.
Brianna, this is actually also a one-credit class. Can you tell us a little bit more about the academic side of this?
Black Chorus is an extremely rigorous academic course. So I think a lot of people join it thinking that, oh, we're just going to come and sing some songs. But you learn a lot. You learn a lot about the history of the music, how it functions in society today, and also how it functioned in the past. Dr. Davis is amazing. She's just a fountain of information, an amazing resource to have, especially for those of us that are music educators. She tells us how to authentically and accurately teach the music, everything down to the pronunciation of the words. You learn so much about performing the music and studying it as well. That is just something that you don't get in a lot of choirs.
Michaela, did you grow up singing in a choir in church?
I did.
And Jerry, how about you?
I joined Chicago Children's Choir for like a really small amount of time, and then I never really picked it up back up till high school.
Okay, but Chicago Children's Choir is pretty rigorous, and you learn a lot there too, I know. Michaela, what have you learned in chorus that you maybe didn't learn being part of a church choir? I wonder what you've learned about the history and the tradition when we're thinking about sacred Black music in this country.
I've definitely just learned more about the meanings behind the songs. I think in church, often we would learn the song, especially in youth choirs, we would learn the songs and they'd say, praise God. And that would be kind of the end of it when it comes to understanding what the song is about. But in Black Chorus, we understand the setting that the song would take place in, how it would be performed or how it would be sung in the moment that it was created. So it really just gives me kind of a good foundation to understand the music.
Okay, so we're about to hear you all performing, not just the three of you. There's not 8 or 9 of you guys with us today. I Open My Mouth. Let's take a listen to that.
I open my mouth to the Lord, and I won't turn back. I will go, I shall go, to see what the end's going to be. I open my mouth to the Lord, and I won't turn back. I will go, I shall go, to see what the end's going to be. I open my mouth to the Lord, and I won't turn back. I will go, I shall go, to see what the end's going to be. I open my mouth to the Lord, and I won't turn back. I will go, I shall go, to see what the end's going to be. I will go, I shall go, I will go, I shall go, I will go, I shall go, to see what the end's going to be.
You're listening to The 21st, and that is the U of I's Black Chorus. They just performed I Open My Mouth. In studio with me is three of the members of U of I's Black Chorus. Vice President Jerry Buffor is here with us. Jerry, so there's about 8 or 9 of you guys with us today. How many people are in the chorus in total?
I can't give you the exact number, but it usually falls within the 80 to 90 range.
And we were just hearing I Opened My Mouth, and Michaela, before you guys sang that, you were talking about how you've learned a lot about the music. And I wonder what you can tell us about that particular piece to provide a little bit more context about it.
I Opened My Mouth to the Lord is actually a field holler.
Field hollers is a specific subset underneath the broader category of spirituals. So with spirituals, you have so many different subcategories. You have jubilee, sorrow songs, and this one is a field holler. So it's a work song. They would sing it out in the fields while they were working. And when we go into this ripple effect of, I open my, and all the different parts take a place, you can hear it's supposed to be an effect where you have this idea in your head or this image in your head of the slaves singing it across the plantation. And so it's starts over here, and then another group picks it up when they hear it, and then another group picks it up when they hear it just across the field in general. So that's why it's called a field holler. It starts out in the field and they start singing it, and then it just picks up and it comes into this layered effect because people, as they hear it, they're singing it in different pockets of time.
That's Brianna Tyler, who's the TA with the U of I's Black Chorus. Jerry, I wonder what you've learned about the history of African American music. It's kind of a big question, but I wonder what you have taken away from the things that you have learned in Black Chorus.
We pretty much go all the way back from the 1800s to mainly now, and we really see the continuum that is African American music. And it does start with the field hollers and the spirituals. Eventually, we get to the traditional gospel, which has maybe some roots within the blues. And then from there, we get rock and roll, we get rhythm and blues, we get soul, funk, hip hop. From there, just the list continues.
We need to take a break. When we come back, we will hear more from the U of I Black Chorus. Stay with us. Just after the break, we'll hear more from three members of the chorus who are with me here in studio, Brianna Tyler, Michaela Odom, and Jerry Bofor. And we'll hear a couple more songs. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're revisiting a conversation with the U of I's Black Chorus. I spoke with them back in March ahead of their concert at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Brianna Tyler is the TA and a master's student getting her degree in music education. Michaela Odom and Jerry Bofor were both seniors at the time. They've since graduated, but they were the president and vice president of the chorus. There are about 80 members of the Black Chorus. About 9 of them stopped by our studios in Urbana. I asked Jerry to introduce the song, Joy.
So this song is Joy, and it is a contemporary gospel song. You get to hear our illustrious graduate assistant, Brianna Tyler.
So let's take a listen to Joy.
There's beauty in my brokenness. I've got true love instead of pain. There's freedom though you've captured me. And I've got joy instead of mourning. There's beauty.
There's beauty in my brokenness.
I've got true love. Never been so free, caught in your love for me.
You love me.
I never been more secure, knowing your heart, Lord.
That was Joy from the U of I's Black Chorus. You heard Brianna Tyler as a soloist. She is a TA. She's a master's student at the University of Illinois and in studio with me talking about all of this. President of U of I's Black Chorus, Michaela Odom, is also with us. Both of you, Jerry and Michaela, vice president and president, have been involved with this for your entire time on campus here, your entire 4 years on campus, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I wonder how much Black Chorus has been part of a community or your community when you think about your time at U of I.
When I came to U of I, believe it or not, it was not my first choice school. So my freshman year, I was only partially feeling campus, and my first day was pretty awful. I had a horrible major at the time. Classes were long. I was tired walking around campus and hungry, and it was the end of the day, and I get to choir, and it was like stepping into a kind of like a different world. It was warm. It was inviting. The community in Black Chorus, we're a support system for each other. We love each other. We uplift each other. And that was kind of what I needed to actually almost keep me at this university, because I was not feeling it. And I love it now. But the choir has been so influential in my time here.
So do you mean you might not have even stayed at the U of I if it hadn't been for the people that you, the support system that you created through the chorus?
Yeah, going by, you know, my freshman year, it was rough. But Black Chorus definitely felt like home.
And just to add on to that, there aren't a lot of spaces and a lot of predominantly white institutions or PWIs where you can go to and be in the majority as a person of color. So I think it also gives students of color a place, you know, on campus where they can feel validated. We're singing the music that's of their culture. And so I think it gives them a chance to feel important, you know, and in so many places they don't feel important. And I think at Black Chorus, it gives them opportunity to feel comfortable, to feel important, to feel welcome, to feel validated in their entire experience.
Jerry, so you're a senior, so I'm going to ask you what your most favorite memory is of being in Black Chorus so far.
I would say it would have to be the year before last when we did the last symposium. Honestly, with the conference that we run, like those 3 days, you're just going through it with everybody around you and then all the other people that you're really just meeting for the first time. And then our clinicians, too, a lot of them have been in the same seats that we've been in years back. So hearing about what they have been able to accomplish and just a lot of what they're doing now is just really inspiring. And I would say that music, the music we learned back then, that was pretty much the most joy I've had singing, because a lot of that music required so much from a musician, but also from a spirit.
Brianna, can you tell us a little bit about the symposium?
Yeah, so the symposium is a 4-day biennial conference dedicated to the study and performance of Black sacred music. And so we bring these clinicians, most of which are alums. This year we have 9 clinicians. 5 of them are U of I alums. And I mean, they're doctors and they're lawyers and they're, you know, in these high, lofty places with their careers. But they've always held on to the Black sacred music tradition. They were members of Black Chorus when they were here. So they come back, we bring them on campus, and they teach, hearkening back to what I said about Black Chorus being a purely educative experience when you do perform. They will actually give lectures and lessons on what their particular area of focus is with spiritual music, and then they teach us music. So we always start off with a song. We all sing together as a community. It's open to community members in the Champaign-Urbana community by invitation. And we start with a song. We all sing together. One of our clinicians will come and he'll give a lesson. They'll talk about a topic. Last year, I mean, we even had, you know, a lesson on why we learn things from the oral tradition, because that's how we learned music back when, you know, the spiritual was born. We learned it by mouth. Everything was oral. And so that's how we teach it. And then we go into a group rehearsal, community rehearsal. Everybody comes together and we sing again. So we start the day with song. We end the day with song. And everyone who gets to come, we give giveaways. And it's a really, really good time. And then at the end of the conference on Sunday, the community members that participated in the conference with us actually joins Black Chorus on stage, and they sing on stage with us. So that 5 o'clock concert, everyone's going to be on stage. That's a part of the conference that we sing. We just give away our hearts and we give away what we learned throughout the 4 days.
Michaela, can I ask you one last question just about the U of I Black Chorus? We were just talking about how it's a space on campus, be on a campus there where African Americans and people of color are definitely a statistical minority. I wonder, with the U of I Black Chorus, it's not just Black students, so, right? This is actually a pretty diverse group.
Of course. I would even go so far to say as Black Chorus is one of the most diverse organizations on campus. Just because it is called Black Chorus, I think a lot of people kind of get confused or they misinterpret it. We're Black Chorus because we sing the music of the African-American diaspora, but everyone is welcome, not just Black students, but everyone from everyone of other races and ethnicities. So it's really a great experience, especially if you aren't familiar with this music, because it gives you an opportunity to participate and learn about it. And it's also great for students like me, where it is like a place of cultural familiarity.
Yeah, and I just like to add on that too, that a lot of it, even just coming in each day, it just feels like an exchange, because all of us, we're inputting our soul and our passion into the music and just internalizing it all together. And it really becomes a greater feeling of community, because the person right next to you, they can share that same feeling with you. And both of you don't even have to really say it out loud, but you can only just sing it.
So I'm afraid that's all the time we have, but I wonder if we can end on one more song. Michaela, can you tell us about this last song?
Hold On, Change Is Coming is actually one of my favorites. I have the honor of leading this song. It's a really encouraging piece. If you're ever feeling down, this is the song to pull up on your playlist.
Thanks again for being with me. Brianna Tyler is a master's student at the U of I. She's the TA for the U of I's Black Chorus. Jerry Boffor and Michaela Odom are the vice president and president. They're both seniors. Guys, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. I always wanted to be on radio.
That does it for us today. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're also on Facebook. If you want to search there for the 21st, you can like us, and it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, if you want to leave us a voicemail as well, send us an email, or remember our social media handles, all you have to remember is our website. That's 21stshow.org. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.
How can you smile when your world is crumbling down? I said, here's my secret. When I wanna cry, I take a look around and I see that I'm getting by, and I hold on.
Hold on.
This change is coming.
Change is coming.
Hold on.
La 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 la
coming.
Hold on.
Good job.